Welcome to episode 2 of the Over the Counter podcast. I'm Mark Eastcheck.
And I'm Andrew Whaley.
And here we're here today to talk about, does your life have a story? I think it's maybe one way to ask the question.
Something like that, yeah.
We want to talk about life stories and how they come about, mm-hmm. and the role of narrative in our own self-understanding and that kind of thing. And we've got, I think, quite a lot of thoughts about this. But before we get there, Andrew, can you tell me what coffee we're drinking?
We are drinking the Finca Hartmann Maragahipe from Novo Coffee. It's a Finca Hartmann is a Panamanian estate, and it is I think Maragahipe is a varietal, like Bourbon or Typica, which would be like in wine would be like Cabernet, Pinot Noir, and it's a rare varietal, and they're growing it there. So
in Panama.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I like it. I mean, I think it looks a little red. I told Andrew that it looks kind of like blood to me, or I actually accused him of putting blood in my coffee, but maybe to say it looks more like a kind of, what's it called? Dutch processed cocoa, you know, that kind of like, reddish brown color that, it doesn't look like your typical like dark black coffee for whatever reason. So, anyway, Andrew, I don't know exactly where we're going to go with this, but...
Well, I mean, it's like, okay, look, it's... Man, by nature, is a historical being, right? We come into existence. There's a time when we're not. So, I mean, us, angels, animals, all the above, there's a time when we're not, and then there's a time when we are. And then for some of us... You know, angels and humans, we kind of keep going forever.
Right.
Some things start being and then stop being. Right. And so, because of that, in the nature of time, we kind of unfold. We experience things in sequence. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, our true form and kind of who we are, our identity, to a certain extent, develops discursively over time. So, it seems like the process of that and how that comes about and how our identity kind of unfolds, one really rich way to look at that would be through the lens of story or through the lens of narrative.
Right? Yeah, well, it kind of makes me think about psychology and therapy and the idea of talk therapy and Freud, right, and all of that, where to help somebody move from, well, neurosis to sanity or whatever, mm-hmm. you talk. Right, and you ask that person to tell their story, mm-hmm. right? And you, I mean, obviously a trained and licensed psychologist or whatever is trying to elicit from that person a coherent story,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, that's kind of the idea,
right,
behind,
right,
Freudian psychology, right?
Well, I mean, like logotherapy, like Viktor Frankl, Man's, right, Search for Meaning, that whole thing is like, the whole idea is it's purpose, right? And the purpose... kind of unfolds and meaning unfolds as you look at you look at your life, so to speak. And so
And wouldn't you say that depression, maybe not all forms, but a lot of depression is caused by a kind of loss of story,
right?
Right. The despair is brought about by somebody waking up one morning and being like, wow, I don't remember who I am or what I am or why I'm here. And mm-hmm. it all feels meaningless.
Right.
And that's
right.
Where the despair comes from.
Right. And there's the thing is that we use that word. If it sounds weird to use the word story, and it sounds weird to use the word narrative, but it doesn't seem weird to use the word meaning, right? Everyone, regardless of their ideology, will use the word meaning in reference to their life. Or does your life have meaning? Or what gives your life meaning, right? You know, and so it seems like one could ask, well, okay, well then what is meaning in that sense? And I would have to say that there's obviously big overarching philosophical and theological references for that meaning, but on a more common experience of life, it would be, oh, I worked hard and overcame this suffering and this hardship for the sake of, and then either the next chapter in the book is, oh, it paid off, or oh, there's a reversal on it. I graduated and couldn't get a job.
I think the stories that we're talking about, you know, are dramatized by literature and movies and things in such ways that our actual lives aren't, right? And I think a lot of times normal human life feels a lot more like the movie Groundhog Day or The Office or something, where it seems as though every single day is exactly the same as the one before and is exactly the same as the one that's going to follow. That yesterday, today, and tomorrow are basically the same. That's just this giant cycle of repetition.
I think Groundhog Day, bringing that up, I love that film. And that is a genius thing to bring up because...
Well, thank you for complimenting me on my genius.
Well, I said it was genius.
I'll try to return the compliment at some point.
I wouldn't say you were a genius. I think it was genius. I'd be willing to throw that. So it seems like here's a character in Bill Murray's character where he is presented with an icon of the absolute most meaningless. No matter what he does,
right,
he's not getting out of it. The next day he wakes up, there's Sonny and Cher singing "I Got You, Babe," and they're like, "Oh, it's gonna be a cold one," and it's like he knows, "Oh, here we go again," right? But then the whole story of that is how he breaks out of that meaningless cycle, is how he learns to kind of take meaning in the moment and to have to do the right thing, to do the good thing, to expand himself in that ever-present kind of cyclical moment, right? So he catches the kid that falls out of the tree every day. He's there with a jack to help the old ladies when the tire blows. He does all that stuff. He learns to speak a language and play piano. He does all that stuff in this ever-repeating day. And over the course of time, he kind of whatever needed to happen to him to learn the lesson that this was this kind of conundrum was being given to him for, he learns it and he becomes who he's supposed to be, and now he can break out of that meaninglessness.
Well, I mean, it is a great parable for the way that we experience life. You know, that life does feel very repetitive a lot of times. It doesn't change very much. And a lot of the change that does need to come about, we can only bring about in very small increments.
Right, right.
And I mean, if you think about it in terms of like weight loss, or if you think about it in terms of learning something like a new language, or earning a degree, or saving up for a house or something,
right,
or for retirement, that those are long-term goals or whatever that can only be achieved by making consistent decisions in the same direction,
right,
that build that habit over a long period of time, and so that you can arrive at whatever destination you're seeking.
Well, it's funny. You can see this like this very dis. It's funny. This is going to be a great time where our two personalities and our two stories are going to be giving different insights into this, because you strike me as you and your family. Somebody you've done the things that are right over time, and you've been disciplined and you're frugal and you bought a house and you've got the PhD at a fairly young age and you're doing, I've kind of been all over the place and had a lot of reversals and a lot of, oh, here's what I need to do. And then I try to do it. It doesn't work out. But then something really cool kind of comes out of that. And so I'm in a position where it's like, it hasn't really made sense for years on end at times. And now, but in hindsight, I can look back, and that's what kind of started this topic, is you and I talking about kind of my experience in ministry and vocation and all that. And I look back over time and I'm trying to put together some kind of meaning, trying to find a thread that runs through that of kind of a narrative.
Okay, so this comes to a really important part of the discussion, right? The idea of understanding your own story and interpreting your own story.
Right.
Right. It's not so much about just knowing the facts of this happened, then this happened, then this happened,
mm-hmm.
right? It's about being able to understand all of those events in relation to one another. That's the challenge, I think. I don't think that the challenge to me is not so much just having a record of all the events,
right?
Even though that can be challenging in itself, and everybody has a hard time putting together, you know, photo albums or whatever else. But the real challenge, I think, is interpreting that story in a way that's meaningful.
Right. Right.
So one of the things that I think is fascinating about our day and age, that's really bizarre too, is that there are people who are really scared of losing their story.
Right.
Of losing their memory. And so they engage in what's called life logging. Have you ever
heard
of this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've heard.
So you basically wear like a necklace camera every day, 24 hours a day, and it takes pictures once every 30 seconds or so. And you then upload all of those pictures to some database or whatever, and it basically provides a kind of record, so to speak, of your memory.
Wow.
And there are people that go even further than that and try to record audio.
Right.
So they try to record all their conversations. They try to record all of the digital stuff that they produce, whether it be emails, instant messages, whatever. And they retain it all in some sort of hard drive or whatever, as if, in a certain sense, it could replace their memory. So there's this one guy who does this, who's like one of the lead life logging people.
Okay. This was on NPR, wasn't it?
No. This was in a book I read.
I heard this guy interviewed.
He has this bizarre theory that eventually artificial intelligence will come about or whatever, and they'll be able to take the memory stuff that he's produced and plug it into some sort of avatar AI type thing, right, so that he can basically live forever and retain all of his memories as a kind of cyborg / artificial intelligence / robot kind of thing. Because he's totally a materialist. He doesn't believe in an afterlife.
Right. And if you are a materialist, then you have to figure out a way to continue that, because you are only the ones and zeros of your digital self that has captured this and put it into synapses or whatever. I mean, you are a recording device,
right?
And that's all you are,
right?
In a sense, right? So it seems like it makes sense that would be the case. But I think I've thought about this though too, is I've tried to go back and piece together, you know, memories, like, where was I living then? Oh, that's right. And I was working that job over it. Oh, yeah. And I used to hang out with so-and-so. Right, we would go to that. Oh, I forgot about that coffee house that used to be on Broadway over there that we used to go to. Yeah, we did the open mic nights. Oh, I forgot. I used to love doing spoken word. Why don't I do that anymore? You know, and you think that through. And I had this idea. This is a free idea. You're going to get a lot of free ideas if you listen to this podcast. I just like 5%.
Or if you come to the Totally Legit Coffee House. Coffee bar.
I mean,
I
wouldn't mind having 5% or 3% if it's really successful. But I what about like a Wikipedia type page where you could build your own page and then all your friends and family from over the years could plug in stuff.
Well, that's already happening with Facebook.
It kind of is, right?
Yeah, so you can have other people are saying, this person went to high school with me, this person went to college with me.
But if I could say, if my friends could remember, they have a letter that I sent them and they could tell me what my address was at a certain time, where I lived and when I moved, and you could piece together a timeline of who, oh, you remember, we used to hang out, remember so-and-so used to come over for dinner, oh, that's right, you know? You kind of get a feel for. And then you could go back and compare it to your journals and stuff, and you could kind of get a feel for in what context you were thinking what. And you could kind of see over time how you've developed and your desires and your insights and your understanding of things have developed. I mean, you could do that somewhat just with a journal.
Yeah.
But with that kind of idea, you could get kind of 360 on it and kind of see it from all these different perspectives and all these different even mundane perspectives, like where you lived and where you worked at that time. And
okay, but I mean, are we really getting to the heart of what we want to talk
about?
No,
we're not. I mean, where are we going to get to it?
We're talking about life logging, which is just a bizarre thing in and of itself. Okay, so what about this whole idea of narrative story, interpreting your own story? I mean, how does it... I mean, I guess from my perspective, I feel like a lot of people have begun to treat their lives in a kind of non-narrative fashion.
Right.
Okay, and what I mean by this is like cutting themselves off from their families, right? Where they don't really...
Meaning narrative is what's the I can't remember, there's a quote that says that with the life becomes just one damn thing after another.
Right.
I mean that's what it is. It's just a sequence without a storyline. It's a sequence without it's not going towards anything, it's not coming from something. There's no backbone to the narrative. It's just stuff that happens.
Right. Okay. So one example of this, I think it was Time Magazine published a few weeks ago an article about the kid-free life.
Right. Right.
And this idea of DINKs, dual income, no kids.
Yeah, I have friends like that. Yeah.
Okay. Where basically the idea is to get married, have a double income, and not have children, and have this kind of lifestyle. But I mean, I just don't even. I guess what puzzles me so much about that is that it's an end of the story.
Right.
Right. It's like deliberately cutting off the family tree. You know.
Right. But you get
deliberately bringing an end to the story of your family.
Right.
Your ancestors.
And that's the thing. Is it's funny. I was at the Communion Liberation New York encounter in January, and this French philosopher, Fabrice Ajab, which is he's a really strange guy. He's a traditional Thomist, very traditional Thomist, Aristotelian, who does kind of a theology of the body kind of thing, though. But he's not coming from the phenomenological perspective. And one of the things he had you do, which was made people very uncomfortable, was he says, stand naked in front of the mirror. Like, stand naked, look down at your underbelly, he says. And he's first, you see your navel. What does my navel tell me? He says. It tells me that I did not make myself. I come from somewhere. I come from someone. And then he goes with the traditional, you know, theology of the body, has you look further and say that I'm called to other. I'm called for the story to continue. And it's not complete by myself. Mm-hmm. Right? And so that's why I started the whole thing with, there was a time when we were nothing. Everything was a time when there was nothing, right? But then there was a time when we were nothing. And then we came into being, and we progress and become more ourselves, hopefully, over time, right? And so I think that's brilliant that you're talking about the concept of the DINK. Is like this, like, no, there's not going to be a sequel to this book.
Right.
There's not going to be another movie. This is not going to be a trilogy. Right. We are going to cut this off.
Right. We're going to end the story.
Right. And the only thing you're going to be able to do is to buy. It's kind of like they did that movie Donnie Darko that is about time, you know, this time travel and weirdness and stuff. It depends on what you think it's about. But then they released another film, and I haven't seen it yet, and it's called S. Darko. And it's the exact same story told from the perspective of the little girl. So maybe it's like all you can do is have different perspectives on this one sequence that happened because the story's not going to continue.
Right.
But it's funny, that really kind of kills the idea that there's a terminus, there's a telos, there's an end, there's a target that we're going towards, which right that gives some kind of meaning to this. And so when you cut that off through the double income, no kid thing or the materialist thing, you end up life logging. You're just getting a dog and just people can like look at your Facebook when you're gone. Right. I mean, because it doesn't, you're not going towards something. You're not becoming anything. Right.
Can we go back to belly buttons for a second?
We can't go back to belly buttons for a second.
So this is something that's really bizarre, but, basically, every religion in the world has a place which they consider to be the belly button of the world, the omphalos. Okay? And so what's fascinating about this in Christianity, right, is that place is Jerusalem. And in St. Cyril of Jerusalem's cathedral at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem...
It's the Feast of St. Cyril today, right?
Different St. Cyril.
Okay, sorry.
There was a big statue of a belly button. A navel, right?
That is spectacular.
Basically between the Anastasis, like the tomb, uh-huh, and Mount Calvary.
Wow.
The belly button of the world.
The belly button of the world.
Yes. Yeah, so anyway, to me this is really fascinating for a lot of reasons, but basically the idea is that there is a center,
right,
geographically speaking, to the whole world. And that can be symbolized through this idea of the omphalos, the belly button.
Well, I think the idea about the way I think about this narrative thing, and about, I think of narrative as self becoming and self discovery over time, and I think that is to be seen synonymously with the quest for communion with God. And the reason why I say that is,
Okay, I was getting a little nervous there when you were just talking all about self-actualization.
No.
All kind of.
No, think about this. No,
new
age. No, look. Okay, before.
But communion with God, I believe.
Before
in that.
We are, okay, God says that He tells Jeremiah, "Before I created you in the womb, I knew you." So there was something that was Jeremiah before there was physical things that became Jeremiah, right? Because God knew it before He formed it. Now, we know that there's an aspect of persons per se, whether they're angels or us or even divine persons in the Trinity, where before they speak, there's a concept, because that's what the Word is, right? That's the second person of the Trinity. Is God reflects on Himself, this concept emerges, that's this picture of Him, that's the unspoken Word, then later it gets spoken in the Incarnation, right? Well, that's in a sense, you know, the way Gaudium et Spes says that in the Incarnation, God reveals man to Himself, right? It's kind of, we're all kind of like that. We are kind of an incarnation in a sense, right? And in this sense only, that God has this idea of us, but anything that's in God is God to a certain extent. And so God wants to share or communicate an aspect of His being. And so He creates this vast diversity of beings and in most
the book of creation.
Right. And then He makes more particularly man, and He makes man in His image. Right. So there's this idea of us. Merton talks about this in Seeds of Contemplation. I think it's in chapter 2, Things in Their Identity. And where God makes us, and our job during the course of this life is to become exactly who we are.
Because you know, I don't know.
Because who we are is the thought in God's mind of us. And so the search for self, the real search for self, is the search for God.
Okay, so where I'm.
That's my right brain just thought.
What's
the left brain perspective?
The problem though is that we're trying to reconcile the irreconcilable, whatever it's called, irreconcilable. And what I mean by that is. Self-actualization is this kind of philosophical, New Agey kind of approach.
But I'm going to talk about that.
Yeah, well, it cannot be reconciled with what God is calling us to, which is relationship with Himself.
But so, the relationship...
That's what I'm afraid right, that but the kind relationship, of language is getting us
but,
into.
No,
is,
but I'm...
The, is this kind of like,
I'm not scared
I'm trying to become who I'm supposed to be. And it's like, no. God is actually calling you into a relationship with Him. It's not an atomized, like, me-only experience.
No.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Right, but I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that we are something. We are an individual. We are a particular, irrepeatable, priceless, imbued with dignity, instantation. You know, Caro Voitiva says in Love and Responsibility that in kind of in contrast to the classic Aristotelian kind of take on this, right, is that the human person cannot be spoken of merely as an individual of the species Homo, even Homo sapiens, right? So the difference between me and you is not the difference between Rex and Fido, where they're the form of dog individuated by matter, right? There's something more to us. And he says that individuation, that inability for the individual of the species to encapsulate the perfection and the manner of our being, to that inability, we give the name person, right? So we are something. We are someone. And that thing that God knows, the picture that God had in His head, so to speak, before He creates, our job in this life and communion with God is to become as much... To be supple on the wheel and let the potter make us into what he wants to make us, because that is the aspect of his being he wants to communicate. And then when you do that over time, we're kind of carved into that by running from it and being pushed back on. We try to get away. We get swallowed by the whale. We get spit up on the shores of Nineveh. We shake the whale vomit off our head and we move on.
I just think that there are some real difficulties with that way of articulating what we're trying to do here.
We're not talking about the New Agey self-actualization.
That's exactly what it sounds like.
But we're not talking about that. I'm not saying that. All the presuppositions the New Age thing are different from what I'm saying.
But I think also that there's a how do you put this? It's kind of an over individualized approach to the meaning of life.
No, because this, because community,
I'm
the polis, saying, the church, the
I'm
family,
not saying that every single human being
in.
Has the same vocation, but I do think that we all have the same destiny, right? Which is that communion with God. Okay,
right. But that's okay. So there's okay. I'll admit that there is an there's
or
the
beatitude, happiness.
These are right. We have narratives, individual narratives, which are part of bigger narratives, the family narrative or the country's narrative. And those are all part of a larger narrative. And that is God sharing his being and all returning to God, relationship with God in the end. The encapsulation of being back into God, right? This loop that starts with God and it's going to all end with God, right?
Okay, great.
That's the big narrative. And if humans are called to be brought into existence and then live forever in communion with God, right? That's the big story, right? But inside that, look at the saints. You know, I think C.S. Lewis has said that hell is the place of monotony, right? You've got Edith Stein and Aquinas and
Groundhog
Francis.
Day.
You've got all these people who, the more they become like Christ, the more they become completely different than each other.
Yeah, okay, well, we'll have to come back to this topic because I just think we have really different perspectives here, and I've got to think about this a lot longer before I've got a great response for you, but I just, I think there's some difficulty here that we've got to iron out.
I mean, look at the, in the current media right now, everyone's playing up this narrative about the last two popes, right? And they have this stupid narrative, which is basically a Saved by the Bell episode from the early 80s or whatever, like some bad 80s comedy where we used to have this crusty old principal that didn't want us to party and have a good time, but now we got the cool principal, and he's like, yeah, skip school and do beer bugs. I mean, that's stupid, right? But you do have two extremely holy, extremely brilliant men. And one is perfectly happy sequestering himself in the papal palace because really he kind of wants to just be a quiet, shy academic, and he brings people in to talk to him. The new one wants to live among the common man and other priests and stuff, and is supposedly it's been hinted that he likes to sneak out at night with the almsgiver and go talk to homeless kids under bridges and give them food.
Right, right.
They both are very much like Christ.
Yeah.
And the more they became Christ-like, the more they would probably become less like each other. Because they're becoming who God made them to be. And in the end, maybe like in Dante, you have Francis's followers and Francis spending their life praising Thomas and his followers and vice versa. Because this can lead to conflict and ideology. But to become like God is not to become more the same. And I think that over time is the story that develops in a life. Man, this went a totally different direction. I love this. Because this went a whole different direction than we were planning on.
I just think we've got a lot more to deal with here that's we can't deal with in the space of this podcast. But maybe we'll have a return to this kind of theological speculation here. I think there's just a lot of problems. But anyway, I think there's one thing we haven't mentioned yet, which I think is important. I mean, you sort of did when you said the big story.
Yeah,
it's the idea of a meta narrative.
A meta narrative, right?
And
I don't know. The liberal biblical scholars use the word meta narrative. I don't know that I'm comfortable with this language, Mark. I'm kidding. You're totally kidding. I'm reversing.
Do you see what I have to put up with?
Well, I said self-actualization, and you tried to peg me as a New Ager.
Yep, pretty much.
So I've tried to peg you as John Dominic Crossan because you used the word meta narrative. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I love the idea of meta-narrative. Go ahead. Meta-narrative. Tell me what you're thinking.
All right. So anybody who has an ideology has something of a meta-narrative, namely a big story into which all the small stories can fit.
Right.
Okay. So, I mean, you could think about on a relatively small scale of, say, like the meta-narrative of the United States, for example.
Yeah.
Or the meta-narrative of Europe, the idea of Europe.
Or the West.
Is a kind of meta-narrative. Or
right.
The West, right?
Right.
From Greece down to the present day or whatever.
Right. Well, and that's a meta-narrative that both Europe and America kind of fit in.
Right. Right. And so, but then there's kind of a meta-narrative on a much bigger scale, on the ultimate scale, right? And you have different people trying to tell us different meta-narratives and trying right. to squeeze every story into those narratives. I'm thinking of, for example, physicists who are doing cosmology,
right.
who are trying to tell a certain story of the universe, or biologists.
Or liberation theologians who see it all as the struggle of the oppressed and the oppressor. Right. Yeah.
And a lot of the ideological warfare we witness, whether in academia or elsewhere, is focused on trying to redefine the meta-narrative that mm-hmm. we all mm-hmm. believe in. I think that what's crucial about this idea is that we can't understand or interpret our own individual narratives or stories apart from a bigger story, apart from a meta-narrative.
I think that's perfectly true.
And that's really why, in a certain sense, we need to have beliefs, right? Why we need to... Because the beliefs that we have are in a meta-narrative, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that only beliefs can give you a meta-narrative. I mean, history, to a certain extent, I mean, not materialist history, but history and philosophy and taking reason and looking at what's happened can... I mean, you could look at, like, say... I want to do a podcast at some point just on Poland, right? I am fascinated by Poland, right? But so you look at the movement to democracy, you know... Plato hated democracy because he saw it as the tyranny of the many, right?
Right, mob rule.
Mob rule, right? So then you have in the French Revolution, you have this idea of freedom from religion, right? Let's say and all that. And then you have, like, in the American Revolution, you have this concept of freedom of religion, right? And then in Poland, in the Polish Republic, you have this idea of freedom through religion. You know, in solidarity and when they threw off the shackles of communism, solidarity, Lech Walesa and all that is a religious movement. They're going to mass.
Right.
These common men, working men are going to mass and then going out and protesting. Right. And so there's a development in the way that democracy handles belief and the way that democracy handles that. So you can kind of see... So you can look at that just through the lens of reason and see a change over time where democracy has to be kind of antagonistic to religion, and it ends up being fueled by religion, right? So, I mean, those are kind of big meta-narratives, and that's not belief, right? Do you see what I'm saying? Am I making any sense here?
Yeah, no. Well, I think all history is belief.
Ooh.
Right. We can talk about this more at length, but basically all history writing is basically relying on the testimony of others.
Okay, yeah. You know what I mean? It's a trust.
Yeah, it's a kind of trust.
Faith in the sense of, like,
yeah,
trust.
It's not like a scientific experiment in a laboratory in a vacuum, right? It's a combination of facts in a particular
right.
sequence
right.
that has a certain intelligibility to it
right.
that's granted that intelligibility by the historian who's writing it.
Right, and but that being said, it's like we deal with that right now. I mean, I believe there's a place called China. I've seen products that were labeled that they were made there.
Right. I've been there.
You've been there, and I trust you.
Yeah.
I've seen it on maps.
Right.
But it's possible that someone made those labels, and you'd like to mess with people, and it turns out that the maps are all wrong, and maybe there isn't a China. I haven't seen it with my own eyes.
So, but anyway, we'll have to talk about history writing at some point, but I'm afraid that our podcast on story has to come to an end at this point.
Oh, and I love that this podcast is ending. In some way, this is beautiful, because part of the idea behind this podcast is that we're going to have real conversations, unscripted, unplanned, and we really didn't get anywhere today. We didn't come to an agreement. We didn't come to a meeting of the minds. The bullet points didn't get checked off.
We at least
off.
Found that we have some sort of disagreement that we haven't quite defined yet.
Right, and now we can move on to that maybe in the next podcast. Maybe we'll revisit it later.
Yep.
And so you got the eavesdrop on a real conversation that takes place between men who are very different and very alike in some ways. And I don't know, maybe people will find that interesting. I don't know. I found it interesting.
Well, at least we'll have a good story to tell.
All right. And another drink to drink next
okay.
time.
So this is Mark and Andrew signing off from episode 2 of the Over the Counter podcast.
See you later. Thanks for listening.